The Literature of Rome, Livius. Perhaps here, after the Augustan age, would be the very best time to speak of the literature of the Roman people. Nothing, you must know, tells the character of a person, boy or girl, man or woman, as the kind of books he reads. So with a nation, nothing tells so clearly the thought or the character of the times as the literature it sends out into the world. For full 500 years after the founding of Rome, there was no literature at all. If you recall what was going on in those first 5 centuries, I'm sure you will see at once why this was so. Think what the people were busy about: establishing their country, subduing their neighbors, setting up and pulling down their kings and governments. Is it any wonder that no attention was paid to learning, and that therefore no literature marked the time? Men who stand sword in hand have little time to think beautiful thoughts or to write grand verses. It was not until about 250 years before the birth of Christ that Livius, a slave, began to write plays, which he himself acted before the Roman people. The Romans were delighted, carried away with this new amusement. The writings of Livius became textbooks in the Roman schools. His acting was the pride of the people. Indeed, so much did he act and sing that he lost his voice and was forced, in order to keep his place before the people, to have his song sung by a boy hid in behind the stage curtain, while he himself acted in pantomime before the people. This would seem a strange sort of play-acting in these days, but the Roman people were not over particular and were eager for amusement and entertainment of any sort. Nevius was a soldier poet. He was perhaps the last of the native minstrels, that is, the last of those singers found in the early history of every country, who go about the country singing to the people ballads of love and heroic songs of war. Nevius had a marvelous vein of sarcastic humor running through his songs and ballads. He was keenly alive to all the absurdities and inconsistencies of Roman high life, and did not hesitate to set them forth upon the stage and in his songs. Naturally, the Romans did not enjoy having themselves held up to ridicule, especially as they were forced to admit the truth of the picture set before them, and Nevius was thrown into prison and afterwards banished from the country. Ennius is called the father of Latin song. Indeed, he called himself the Roman Homer. That is, he claimed that in power and in strength, in language and in song, he was to the Roman nation what Homer had been to the Greek nation. Indeed, he told the Roman people that the soul of the great Homer had entered him, and that, therefore, he was Homer. The Romans, always ready to believe in the marvelous, accepted this. And Ennius so impressed his personality upon the nation that they were often spoken of by the Greeks and others as the Ennian people. Certainly put his mark upon Roman literature. One of his writings, A Roman History in Verse, was for 2 centuries the national poem of Rome. Ennius was wiser for himself than Nevius had been. He flattered the great men of Rome, showed them up on the stage in his playing as wonderful beings, but little lower than the gods, and so saved himself from a downfall. Indeed, at his death, the greatest possible honor was paid him, in that his bust was placed in the tomb of the Scipios. In the last century before Christ, we begin to find many illustrious names. There was Cicero, the orator and the delightful letter writer. He had studied in Athens, then the center of learning in all the world, and had traveled in Asia Minor. It was he, you will remember, who detected the conspiracy of Catiline. He had a beautiful home on one of the 7 hills of Rome, and there he delighted to receive his friends in his great library and read with them the books he had so carefully collected from every possible source, and it had so carefully and beautifully copied by his Greek slaves. Sallust is an author known best by his Conspiracy of Catiline. Much of his life he spent in war, but his latter years were given to learning, and in his beautiful home, surrounded by wonderful gardens and groves, rich in flowers and plants from every clime, he too gathered his friends about him and talked and read with them. No name in Roman literature, perhaps, is so familiar to us as the name of Virgil. It was he who wrote the story of Aeneas, the man who, from the shores of Troy, came by fate an exile to the Lavinian shores. This poem, it is said, was written to please Augustus, whose ancestry, it was believed, went back to this same Aeneas. In his last illness, it is said that Virgil begged his friends to destroy this manuscript, telling them that it was as yet but a crude, unpolished, unfinished poem, not fit to be given to the people. We cannot be too glad that this modest opinion of his work was not the opinion his friends held, else we should have lost one of the grandest poems the world has ever known. When thinking of Virgil, we must also think of Horace, for these were two poet friends. Horace was a witty writer, but it is said of him, he was the wit who never wounded, the poet who ever charmed, the friend who never failed. There was in Rome, at the time of Virgil's first writing, a man named Maecenas, a very wealthy, high-minded man, a confidential adviser to the emperor, who took great delight in giving his time, his wealth, and best of all, his influence and his generous encouragement to young writers. It was he who brought Virgil into notice and showed him his power in verse. To this Maecenas, Virgil carried his friend Horace, who, in turn, found Maecenas the same generous adviser and willing helper. The friendship of these three pure, high-minded men was a beautiful, ideal, helpful friendship. I hope sometime you may read about it. It may influence you to be generous and helpful, as these three friends were to one another. Later we have in Roman literature Livy the historian, whose histories, too fanciful to be quite accurate, are yet so full of grace and enthusiasm and an easily flowing eloquence that they are delightful to read. Then there was Pliny the Elder, a most untiring reader and writer. His nephew, Pliny the Younger, in speaking of him, says, "He rose at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and he studied oftenest till midnight. While he ate, he always had a book read to him, and he considered all time worse than wasted that was not devoted to study." This Pliny perished in that eruption of Vesuvius by which Pompeii and Herculaneum were destroyed. Pliny the Younger and Tacitus were literary friends and were the two leading intellectual men of their times. It is said that once one of these men stood talking with a stranger, a well-read, intelligent man from some province outside of Italy. Suddenly the stranger stopped and, looking his companion full in the face, said questioningly, "Who can you be? You are either Pliny or Tacitus." Juvenal was a mocking, eloquent, sneering writer, whose writings are full of most scathing condemnation of wrongdoing among the higher as well as the lower classes of Rome. Had he lived in the time of Nevius, he would have been torn limb from limb by the people whose vices he so exposed. Seneca was the tutor and guardian of the detestable and cruel-hearted Nero. Seneca's devotion to Nero was something pitiful in its intensity and blind loyalty, but there came a time when Nero was poor and was wretchedly in debt. Seneca was rich. What more natural thing for a man like Nero to do than to accuse his old friend of conspiracy, seize upon his property, and sentence him to death? Seneca, it is said, met his death bravely, saying, "I am glad even to serve Nero in my death." Little did he deserve a friend whose love was so unselfish, so loyal, so divine.